hello, everyone. Welcome to Safe Space, the ABA podcast. My name is Michelle Zeman. I am your host for tonight. Be sure to listen up for the code word so that way you can get your free CEUs. I am super excited to dive into this particular topic, all about ascent-based practices, along with my guest tonight, Bryce Lang, aka the ABA Unicorn. Hi, Bryce. Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
I'm super excited to have you here. You know, as I was telling you before, this conversation is so necessary. You know, we have really like come into this field where, you know, when it comes to ascent, people say it's new, but it's not really new. It's something that's been around. And so it's like, we need to educate people.
Yes. I remember from one of your recent podcasts with the Psycho ABA Babbles with Lauren and Erica, that was a huge talking point, is how it isn't new. It's new for us in the world of ABA, but you know, these practices are not in fact new. And I'm so happy that we're finally getting on the train.
Yes, absolutely. Oh, I'm super excited. Let's take a dive right in because I am so ready to talk about this. So first, tell us a little bit about yourself and share about your journey into the world of ABA.
Yeah, so I'm a Colorado-based analyst. I love a good cup of coffee, and I have rats. I've owned rats for about 4 years now. Right now, I'm down to 3, and the most I've ever had in one cage is 13.
Wow.
I'm a little bit of a nerd. I think all of us are, and just kind of silly. That's me. You know, I dye my hair a lot of fun colors. Right now it's black. But underneath it all, I'm just a fun loving blonde.
I love that so much. I love that so much. Oh my goodness. How did you get into ABA and how did you get really into ascent-based practices?
Yes. So my undergrad is in general psychology, and it's more than just, you know, some people are like, oh yeah, I had an intro to psych class. No, I took abnormal psychology, cognitive psychology, all the different things that you could. I did an IO psych course, and I had the intentions of possibly being a social worker or maybe even a family and marriage counselor. I was really ready to move out of my parents' house and be on my own and find my big girl job. And so I just remember I'd be on Indeed every single day. I wasn't sure if I wanted to get my master's degree just yet. So I'd be typing away, looking for jobs. What can you do with a psychology degree, a bachelor's degree, you know, more specifically in psychology? And then on Indeed, I found a job for an RBT. And I was like, what's this? And when I read more into it, I was like, oh, yeah, ABA. We talked about that very brief in one of my classes. And it was for a center-based company. And the rest is history. That was about 5 years ago for me. And then I loved it so much that I went and got my master's degree, became a BCBA, and here we are.
Yay, that's so exciting. That makes me so happy. You know, you got into it, you fell in love, and then, you know, you started really getting into more of that like ascent-based, you know, compassionate behavior analysis. So let's talk a little bit about that. Tell us a little bit about your experiences and how you became so interested in ascent-based practices.
I have always been a people person and just very soft, very empathetic, and that's just me. So I was already recognizing when people were not using ascent-based practices before I even knew how to label it. And so one example is when I was in RBT and I was working at that center, oftentimes, you know, full physical prompts and follow through and forced compliance was being used, you know, and early in those days, I think a lot of people have this story, especially when we're self-reflecting, and it is really important to be, you know, to recognize that I did not do good practices. And, you know, I was following along with behavior intervention plans and ABA was new to me, and it still didn't feel right, right? I can say, oh, I didn't know what I was doing. I was listening to the BCBA as I should, but ultimately it didn't feel right. It didn't feel good. And so without totally knowing maybe the right terminology, the right questions to ask, what to say, I was having conversations very early on with my BCBAs. Why do we force compliance if it's creating such big pushback from our clients? Why is my learner going to the table every 5 minutes when they're only 5 years old? And why aren't we playing? What's the purpose of learning to touch a yellow triangle, an array of three? Where are we going with that? Are they going to go to school? Is that a school goal? You know, and so starting to put all these things together, sometimes it was well met, sometimes not so much. But I think even, you know, when I was, what was that, like 5 years ago when I was in RBT, I don't think ascent-based practices were such a hot topic as they are now.
Yeah, it's so true. You know, it's really funny because I've had BCBAs come up to me and be like, you know, Michelle, I didn't know anything about like ascent or ascent based practices until either I became a BCBA or right as I was getting my hours collected. And I'm like, okay, no, we got to change this like now, mm-hmm. because this is not a new thing. Like, this needs to be happening very early on in your career, you know?
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And, you know, now I'm able to supervise. So I became a BCBA in January of 2023. So a little over a year now. But yes, that is definitely something I try to instill in my student analysts. And one of my favorite ways to share that is honestly through social media, because that's how I found out more. I made an Instagram because I was like, I kind of want to be an ABA influencer, see who else is out there. And then I started hearing the talk of Ascent and I was like, oh my gosh. And it rocked my world. And the rest is history.
it's so amazing to like even see that Ascent is being promoted that much more in social media. And it's, you know, it makes me question that much more. Why wasn't this promoted before?
Yes.
You know, another thing that I think about too is, you know, negative experience with non-Ascent behaviors. I know that you and I have talked a little bit about negative experiences. So can you tell our listeners a little bit about a negative experience that you had dealing with non-ascent, and how were you able to get through that? You know, what did you do?
Yeah. I actually, you know, one story I tell people all the time is when I wasn't even an RBT yet, I was still a BT. And so I was still going through my 40-hour training to become an RBT. And I was working with a learner who had elopement behaviors from your good old token economy, DTT. and the VIP was that we, under all circumstances, could not let the learner escape, and we had to bring him back to the table. And so, you know, our antecedent interventions were to place the table against the wall so it couldn't be scooted forward. The learner was in his chair, and then our leg would sit behind the chair, right? So he couldn't scoot back. I didn't feel comfortable doing that. And so I just sat comfortably with my learner, and he did elope from the table while we were running a token economy. And then when I stopped him, as I was instructed and I was being overlapped by my BCBA, he flopped to the floor. And when he would flop to the floor, it wasn't just a sit down, he would flop and throw his head back, right? So that's a huge, huge, huge concern. I don't want his head to get hurt. And I felt comfortable with the BIP, but I hadn't had any other kind of training. I truly, like, I wasn't an RBT yet. And so I really was not seasoned in any of my skills. So I'm looking at my BCBA and I'm like, help, you know, what do I do? She's just coaching me through what the BIP said. And ultimately we had to three-step physical prompt, right? So stand up like me. And then instead of doing a partial physical, we were required to go right into that full physical with your like open Barbie hands underneath his armpits. And so, you know, the BCBA is telling me to do that. And, my learner, of course, he's upset. He's crying, he's flopping. And, you know, I'm trying to protect his head with my legs because, and my hands, and trying to prevent him from hitting his head, because at this point he was really full flopping back. And, you know, my SDs were increasing his behaviors, and I was turning to my BCBA and I was like, hey, I don't feel good doing this. Somebody needs to take over. I don't have training. This doesn't feel good. I just kind of stopped. I'm keeping my learner safe, you know, but when I stopped, of course, he's like, okay, you know, everything's stopping. And my BCBA's response, unfortunately, was, if you don't follow through, I don't think this is the right job for you.
Oh,
yeah. So I just, even now it brings up feelings, and I have to, that was long ago. And I couldn't follow through. And so I said, well, I need a mat, and I think I need some help. I need somebody else to take over. Now's not a good time. And I went into the break room, and I tried to rehab that same conversation with my BCBA. And I said, I love this job. This job is for me. I just can't follow through with things like that, because, you know, if my learner is so upset, there has to be something else we can do to still have a learning rich environment and not make, like, he's five, you know, I shouldn't be in a power struggle with a 5-year-old. The conversation.
And we don't know. Sorry, I don't mean to interrupt. I was just saying, we don't know what this 5-year-old has been through. We don't know if he's been to school all day at that point. We don't know what his setting events are, you know, your basics, like how much sleep did he have last night? Is he sick? You know, we don't know these things. We know that the function of this behavior clearly is to escape the task, but at the same time, we don't know what else is going on internally inside of him.
Yeah. And I can tell you too, I was a little bored of the programming. I think I had asked this kid the same introverbal over and over and over again. And we had like a 4-hour session together, and I was tired of it. There's no way he wasn't tired of it. So definitely not the most enjoyable story to tell, you know, but an important one, because it was definitely a huge non-example. And I'm so glad I didn't let her words deter me, because I did go home and talk to my partner, and I was like, is this job right for me? That was intense, but I don't want to walk away because this just doesn't seem right. This doesn't seem like the way we need to do things.
No, not at all. And, you know, I'm so glad that their words didn't deter you as well, because the thing is, you know, we were taught very early on, even like myself, I was taught the same thing. You had to use full physical prompts. I remember actually a story where a kid was banging his head with his fist, and we were told that we just didn't give him attention because it was for attention. And the kid was wearing the helmet, mind you, but it's like, no, the kid clearly needs to like be given some sort of like something to soothe him. And I actually got in trouble because of that. And, you know, it's so interesting because your BCBA at the time was not receptive to the conversation that you had. Neither was mine. Mine was like, no, this is for attention. You can't be doing that. You have to follow the plan. And it's like, I'm sorry, but the kid is literally punching himself in the face. Do you really think that I'm going to sit here and just twiddle my thumbs and look away while he's beating himself? Like, really? Oh my gosh. I totally understand. Like, and that is a pure non-example of assent behavior. Now let me ask you this. Did you ever have any BCBAs while you were in RBT that were receptive to the feedback about using assent-based practices before you became a BCBA yourself?
You know, I think there was only one, and I still have connections with her today. And when I met her and I worked on, you know, under her and on her cases, I kind of felt like, finally, somebody gets it. And I realized that because I did have a learner who was sick, and we were in home, and he was, you know, able to tell me, I don't feel good today, Miss Bryce. And so I went to her. She was a little late to session, and I went downstairs when she got there, and I was like, hey, you know, our buddy does not feel good today. I don't think we're going to be able to get much done. You know, I think we should go. And she was like, great, let's go. And we walked out and that was it. It was easy. And we got to talk about it too, just how important it is, you know, and mom was okay with it, of course, you know, but how important it is to listen to our learners and pay attention if, you know, they're not able to tell us with words what's going on.
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is just one of the key principles of ascent-based practices. It's listening to our clients, whether they're saying it or whether they're showing body language, that they are just not able to have it, you know, or if there's something truly going on, you know, when it came to the table incident, clearly something was going on. Of course, it was escape maintain, but it's like, okay, but why couldn't we teach him how to request for a break? Or why couldn't we allow those situations where, you know, if he wanted to get away from the table, why can't we go learn in the playroom or go learn on the floor? Like, why does it have to be at a table?
Exactly. And, you know, I think that that really helps click for a lot of people as soon as we're able to change the environment or how we're learning and make it more fun. Really, that's the key. A lot of people are like, oh, how do I do it? You know, it seems so complicated. For me, I think it's actually very simple. Just make it fun and it works.
Yeah, I actually think it's so funny you say that. I think it's actually easier to do the more ascent-based practice than what we are told, because we have to follow a particular procedure and we have to do these three-step physical prompt procedures. And, you know, we're not allowed to reinforce the maladaptive, I say this in quotations because I hate that word, maladaptive behavior. And it's like, you know, why can't we just listen to our clients? As a neurodivergent BCBA, like, that actually lights a fire inside of me. Oh my goodness. And, you know, kind of in your role as a BCBA, you know, first of all, so glad you are a BCBA. Just, you know, having these conversations with you in particular, it makes me that much happier that you decided not to listen to that BCBA who said, if you don't follow through, this is not the job for you. No, this is absolutely the job for you. But in your role, how do you create an environment that encourages ascent from all of your learners?
Yeah. You know, first, I think it's really important to operationally define what ascent and ascent withdrawal looks like for each of my learners, because it's different for each of them. And then I really, really like to model, you know, in addition to writing how to respond to that. And then also the, you know, the replacement behaviors we'll be teaching and, you know, how to, in, well, it's not even really replacement behaviors. It's actually increasing skills for communication. And model that for the RBTs, but specifically for the learners, you know, teaching communication above all else, because most of the time we're talking about those learners that may not have the skill set just yet to communicate in a way that like everybody can understand. But as a practitioner working with the population that we do work with, we have kind of insider knowledge on what to look for and what to watch out for to understand our learners, because we work with this, you know, the same population all day. We're going to pick up on all the cues. In addition to teaching communication, definitely building rapport, having that trust is so important. No different than you and I going to like Starbucks, knowing that we can leave or advocate that we got the wrong coffee. Like, hey, I asked for sugar in my coffee at any time. I want my learner to feel that they can do that with me and, you know, my RBTs as well. And then ultimately instilling confidence in my learners and making them love themselves, you know, helping them love themselves and just feel confident in their ability to say no. And I love when my clients tell me no. I know parents hate it and I'm sure it's infuriating, but I love it. I get giddy. I'm like, you told me no, yes. And they're looking at me like, what? And I'm like, yes, you said no. That is such an empowerment word. Yeah. So, you know, teaching communication, building rapport, instilling confidence, and having fun.
Agreed. You know, and I'm so glad you get giddy over somebody saying no or somebody indicating no, because no is not just a self-advocacy word. It's a safety word.
Yes.
When you think about it, if we teach our children blind compliance, that puts our clients in very dangerous situations, you know? I think about the kid that you were telling me about with the flopping and everything. If we didn't, or if you didn't teach him how to say no, who knows what kind of compromising situations he could be in to this day. And so I feel the power of no is just that much more important to be able to hold on to. I love being told no, or my favorite is when I get told quiet or back off or just a minute. It's the most hilarious thing. Or I'll have some clients who are non-speaking who will just shake their head. I'm just like, yes, I will gladly honor that. I will walk away from you. I will go over there. You do your thing. I'm over there. You know, it's so cool to be able to see that.
It is. And you know, you're doing your job right. Right. Because everybody should have the power to say no. Everybody should.
Yeah.
And everybody be listened to.
Exactly. Exactly. Neurodivergency or not, advocacy across every person. It's just huge. It's huge to be able to understand, you know? And so being a BCBA, do you ever, just out of curiosity, do you ever like run across any BCBAs who are like, why do you do that? Or they like almost judge you for, oh, you're allowing them to escape from the task.
Actually, I currently work with one, and also had an interesting conversation with one this week. So I have come across them, and usually I kind of like to use it as a opportunity to educate and also understand where they're coming from. I ask questions. Why do you think that? Why do you think that I'm feeding into the behavior of escape, or, you know, whatever it is? That's a very interesting point. I did have one BCBA tell me that, I mean, this in the most respectful way, she's kind of like a boomer BCBA, and I call myself like a new age BCBA. She's also brilliant. I really admire and respect her. We had a really good conversation. She works with more, you know, higher magnitude behavior clients, and her viewpoint of ascent is that it's almost like being overly used in making RBTs afraid to do ABA, to do anything, because they're afraid that they're going to cross that boundary. And I thought that was a really interesting perspective, one I haven't heard before. And, you know, I kind of communicated to her, you know, I would disagree, because we as BCBAs have the opportunity to teach that difference, right? We can operationally define ascent and ascent withdrawal and what that looks like with our learners. And so if you see that an RBT maybe isn't acting or, you know, doing something that you want them to do, I think it falls on us, right? Because we're supposed to be the teachers. They're following our plans.
And it's interesting too, because in a way, like, ascent withdrawal does fall on us, but it falls on us because now, you know, it sort of puts us in this pickle of, okay, we want to enrich as much learning as possible, but at what point do we say, okay, maybe we just need to switch things up? I know as a BCBA, I've had to do that before, where it's been like, the kid has had the same targets for the past 2-3 months, not even joking when I say that, 2-3 months. And it's like, why are we still working on this? This is not socially significant. We need to move on to something else. And that does fall on, like, for example, me as a BCBA. It falls on me to say, okay, we need to make program changes. This needs to happen. Or in the case of like a client who refuses to play with puzzles, maybe they just don't like puzzles. Yeah. Maybe they just want something else. Why does it have to be a puzzle of all things?
I know. You know? Puzzles, where did that come from?
I know. It's like, I say this all the time. Assessment tools are simply assessment tools. They're not your guide. They're not your end-all, be-all. They're not your developmental age checklist, essentially. It's a guide. So be creative, you know? And it's like, yeah.
Yeah, you know, I honestly, most of the assessment tools that we use or are required to use, I don't like. I really don't. And I'm like, well, we have to use it for insurance. And there are some goals in there that could be beneficial, you know, for my learner, or at least kind of like a very good starting point. And then I can kind of tune it to my learner, which we're supposed to do anyway, by the way. Visualize your plans.
Yes. It's only in our ethics code, no big deal. So yeah, I mean, I totally get that. And, you know, again, that's just it though, too. Like, we have to individualize our goals. And also too, if we find that something is not working, why are we still trying to do it? Why are we trying to beat the dead horse at this point?
Yes, I have my experience as a BCBA had, I have started with my own clients, you know, fresh clean slate, but I've also taken over a lot of cases. And it's been so interesting to see some of these goals. And sometimes I've looked in there and I'm like, oh, because I've seen it. And you were saying 2 to 3 months. I've seen goals that have been in there for 2 to 3 years. And exactly, I'm just like, yeah. Why have we not changed them? And, you know, there's no phase changes about like, hey, you know, we did 10 seconds, now we're moving to this and whatever, but even so, it seems like a long time. And we have program modification codes that we bill for a reason. And that's what we're supposed to do. And it's okay. If it doesn't work, it's okay to change it. It's okay. You tried something, it didn't stick. That's all right. That's the name of the game. That's our whole job as a scientist.
Very, very that. And, you know, it's so great to hear that, because I'll even like, I've taken over cases from certain BCBAs before too. And I'll talk to the technicians on the cases. And I'm like, how do you feel about this? Be honest with me. I'm a safe space here. Safe space, the ABA podcast, everybody. But I'm a safe space. I want you to be brutally honest with me and tell me what you're feeling about these goals. I'm going to go into your first session. I'm still going to supervise you as if, you know, you're doing your old plan. But I want to get your insight and your experience. And a lot of them will say, I don't like this. I have so many different viewpoints. I feel like this, this, and this. There's confusion on these targets, you know, and they'll open up. They will say something. So I do think that your technicians do have a voice in that as well.
I agree. Our technicians are the ones that know our clients the best, even better than us, because they work with them every single day. I totally come in and I'm like, all right, tell me what I need to change, what's working, what's not working, you know, you tell me. And sometimes I'll have, you know, if I'm a new BCBA on a case, taking over a case, they'll be like, whoa, I've never had this power before. And I'm like, you should have this power, because you are helping me help my learner have power, right? You are the communicator for our learner right now. I need you to tell me, like, what can I fix? What can I change? I love that you ask, what do you like? What's, you know, what do you don't like? And make that safe space, because that's what we should be.
Exactly. You know, and at the end of the day, if we don't provide that space, like, are we really doing our job? Are we really making the progress we want to make? You know what I mean? So I have to ask you to, like, you know, going to, you know, practical strategies and techniques that you use during your sessions. What are some strategies that you use and you model for your technicians that really place the emphasis on the learner's choices, the learner's preferences?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I know I've said this a lot, but operationally define the set withdrawal, right? Because it is kind of like an interesting skill that you can learn and pick up on and, like, know how to do. But if we don't teach others how to do it, they're not going to know. And make sure that I'm a hands-on BCBA. So sometimes I'll even jump in. I'll be like, hey, you want a break? You want to take some IOA data on me? Like, you sit back and I will, you know, do your session for a little bit and just, like, watch me. And sometimes that's when I'm like, is this working? Is this not working? Right. But also teaching how to have client-led sessions. And so what that looks like, right, is letting my learner tell me what they want and in whatever way that is, and just kind of, I think the best way I'm able to do that is by taking off my BCBA hat and just kind of being a fly on the wall.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've ever been told to narrate a session. You're playing with this. I think that has its benefits, but sometimes I'm just quiet and I just sit and I watch. And in that, I'm able to see how my learner plays with toys, what they're gravitating towards. Are they stimming on something cool? Oh, look, they smiled at that thing. What is that thing? Can I use that as, you know, reinforcement? Or I'm noticing that they're carrying around their blankie today, or they have bags under their eyes, or they're kind of sniffly. They, you know, this isn't behavioral, but we can kind of tell when people seem not themselves. They just seem sad. They seem down. And so if I can kind of figure out what it is, you know, or, oh, they seem really exceptionally happy today, or, oh, they're very amped up, you know, maybe we need to kind of do some more sensory activities. Or if we're feeling just kind of down and sad, maybe I just take it easy today. I'm still therapeutic. Or, hey, you're looking a little angry. And what's making you angry? Is it because you don't have the words to tell me? Is it because this task is too hard? You know, a lot of time we're go, go, go. And yeah, it's okay to kind of stop and sit back and check yourself and observe. Yeah. That's the best advice I can give.
I mean, it's very true too. And, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the things that we run into as BCBAs and even like as technicians, some of my technicians will say, I'm so sorry, Michelle, I didn't reach my trial count. I didn't get to collect data. I'm like, it's a goal. It's a target. Like, I mean, it comes off as me not being very compassionate, but I'm like, it's literally not that big of a deal. You did what you could for your session, given the circumstances that you were given. And there are some BCBAs who are just strict on, you have to have these child counts no matter what. You know, if there is less than 3 trials or less than 5 trials on a target, then, and you didn't do that, oh, you failed for the day. Like, no, you failed for the day because you didn't practice compassion.
Yes, with those analysts, I want to go up to them and say, hey, do 50 pull-ups right now. You didn't make it. You failed for the day, right? Everybody, yeah. And maybe some of them could do it, and then I'd have to find something harder, right? But the point I'm trying to make is sometimes we just have days where it's okay for us to have 3 or less of a certain trial, or maybe we don't get to that program because if we're doing a client-led session, maybe it didn't work out that way, right? Yeah. Maybe brother or sister weren't around for us to do a sharing goal, and we were just mostly working on functional communication and asking for more time, because I noticed that every time I was trying to transition, my learner was like, nope, I'm not about it. I want to keep playing with my toys. And I'm like, cool beans. Instead of having you yell, scream, whatever, you know, we're doing, I'm going to have you tell me I need more time. I need a break. Give me space. I want to keep playing, whatever that looks like. Our sessions go a lot better that way. And we're still teaching them a skill.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And, you know, one thing that I think about when it comes to a set is there are some circumstances where a set really can't be withdrawn, you know? Mm-hmm. And how do you navigate that? Like, for example, kid tries to run out into the middle of the street. If they tell you no, part of you really like wants to be like, yes, he said no, but also it's like, I don't want you to get hit by a car today. So how do you manage that?
Yeah, you know, also part of our job is to keep our learners safe. And I think that's when, you know, assent is also kind of coming from the parents as well. They, and consent, right? They're consenting to our care, and, you know, our learners are here to trust us and we're here to keep them safe. And I love that you're telling me no, but I'm going to stop you from running in the street, even if that means that I'm the one that gets hit by the car because I'm pushing you out of the way, you know, and that's important. We can't, the assent is not, oh, they said no, I'm going to let them run in the street, right? And yeah, we could even argue that, I don't know, people who could give consent to doing something like that, you know, who are neurotypical, I think understand the consequences. I want to say, right, let's pretend there's nothing going on. Like, they fully are aware of the consequences. That's different. I would argue maybe our learner doesn't understand the consequences of running in the street. So we are going to keep them safe and then teach them why I had to keep them safe and why I had to cross that boundary and teach them when they can say no and when I'm going to listen, right? And yeah, I think that's a good time to teach them. I'm not going to say yes to you saying no to running in the street because you're going to get hurt.
Yes, exactly. And I bring that extreme of an example up too, because I think sometimes, you know, when it comes to a set, you know, we might think, oh, they said no. Okay, great. But like, you do have to think about those safety implications too, you know? Yes. So that's where I feel like the education of the difference really comes in. But really, like, it should be client-led. And if it is client-led, my opinion personally, and this might be controversial here, chances are that situation probably wouldn't happen if it were more client-led in that sense. You know what I mean?
Yeah, because maybe they were trying to run away from you. And you have to ask yourself, why are they running away from me right now? Instead of wanting to be with me.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, let's go ahead and do our first code word of the day. Our first code word is squeak. Squeak like a mouse. Squeak, that is spelled S-Q-U-E-A-K. That is the word squeak. You know, and so going back to the question of like, why did my learner run away from me? You know, you mentioned those moments where you felt uncomfortable with, you know, the three-step procedure prompting and having to follow through with that. How do you manage those feelings of feeling uncomfortable while still striving to provide effective support to the client that you're serving?
Yeah, you know, that's a little hard of a question to answer because now I feel like I have a lot more control over what I do, right? I'm the boss. I think before, though, you know, putting myself in that situation where I didn't agree with what we were doing is I stay true to myself. And that's just me as a person, too. You know, as sweet of a person as I am, I'm also a very fiery individual. And I have a very loud mouth. If there's something that makes me upset, I have no problem advocating for somebody who is being harmed. And so I use that feeling, you know, I guess I listen to myself. I listen to what's making me uncomfortable. I try to find out why. And I ultimately, you know, stop and reevaluate. So, you know, even now I can control that. But I still stop and reevaluate, maybe seek feedback, you know, check in like, okay, I'm noticing, you know, our buddy today is, you know, engaging in a lot more avoidance behavior, escape behavior. I wonder, did I do something, you know, and I'm okay. Like, I don't try to, it's fine. It's whatever. I listen to it and then I try to fix it. And before it was more so just staying true to myself to be able to push up to this point where I can actually do something about it. And have a voice, you know, talk about it like, ooh, I'm feeling like this isn't working right now. Okay, let's try again. And I'll even tell that into my learners. They'll be like, ooh, this isn't working. Okay, hold on. We're going to pause. Pause, timeout. I tell everybody, pause, timeout. Whoa, okay. And, you know, we just check ourselves.
Yeah. And I feel like that is such an important thing to be able to do is check yourself and kind of see, okay, what is happening in the situation, you know, and it makes me that much more happy that, like, you know, you say, you know, you are very comfortable with like advocating on behalf of a client, you know, when you find them in harm's way. And sometimes, you know, our technicians don't necessarily feel that comfort as well. They might think, oh boy, this is not a good situation. This is what my supervisor's telling me what to do, you know, and this is what their plan is. You know, I've been there. I've seen that firsthand. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, no, I've seen that too. And that's our job to, you know, really encourage them to have a voice. Sometimes I would say more times than not, I get imposter syndrome because I am only 26 years old. And I'm very young. And I have some parents that are like, who is this very young individual? Are we sure they're competent? And that's okay. But I also like to use that to my advantage to create relationships with RPTs to feel comfortable that they can talk to me. Cause they tell everybody, hey, I'm young and impressionable. You can talk to me. You know, I'm not set in my ways. I'm a safe space. I'm cool. I'm chill, you know, and by modeling that behavior of having a voice for the learners. And, you know, I hope that my RPTs can also pick up on that. And, you know, I really try to be as comfortable and cozy as possible.
Yeah. I mean, and I get that for sure, you know, on my end too, like I've had to do kind of the same thing where it's like, you know, if you feel the situation is not safe, please come to me. You know, again, I am a safe space for that purpose. You know, I don't want you to feel that you cannot do this. You know, you can't come to me. You can't say something because at the end of the day, this is your session and you are being impacted by this.
I 100% agree to that. And, you know, I love that you're creating a safe space for people that you might not supervise. Sometimes there are people in our field who kind of get up on a pedestal and they're like, my programming, you know, this is, I'm the king, I'm the queen, I'm the whatever, you know, and they're very like rigid. And I think in those instances, I don't think it's very talked about of, because that's a true interpersonal conflict and, you know, and yeah, and how to handle that as an RBT, because sometimes RBTs are made to feel like they're less than because they don't have the, you know, the four letters.
They don't have the four letters. They don't have the master's degree. They don't have all those things. And it's like, okay, you know?
Yes. Don't get me wrong. I worked really hard for my degree. I would also cut it up with scissors, because at the end of the day, if I'm a crap human, doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. The four letters, I've said this before and I'll say it again, four letters doesn't mean shit at the end of the day. You know, it doesn't mean shit, because if you are not a kind and respectful human being and you are not being respected by the people that you are supposed to supervise or you're supposed to interact with on a day-to-day basis, then what are you doing here? You know, those are the people that I say you don't belong in the field, not the people who question and, you know, engage in more like philosophical doubt of why do we have to do this? I want philosophical doubt happening. And it's so amazing because, you know, again, like you brought up the four letters thing. I actually was in a training when I first got this one job, and the administrator was like telling the technicians that were there, you do not question the BCBA's programming. I'm like, are you kidding me? And this is coming from an administrator, mind you. So I'm like, are you kidding me? Like, you should be coming to me with questions. You should be asking me those questions, especially if you want to grow to become a BCBA, you know? Not just philosophical doubt, please. Please doubt my skills. Please say something to me, because I'm not correct all the time. I know it's wild, but I'm not always right, you know?
Yes. And, you know, BCBAs, have some humility, have some humbleness and some humility. It feels bad. It does. If you're like, ooh, that's kind of embarrassing. Like, I made a typo on my program, or it's not going, or it's confusing. You know, feedback is hard, but also we heavily learn how to give and handle getting feedback. At least I did in my practicum. Yes. You know, it's not easy, but I think the more you practice being okay with it, the easier it does get.
Yeah. True. Feedback is hard, but watching your level of respect and watching, you know, people turn against you and watching people see that you're not listening is harder.
I agree.
Yeah. So I am definitely right there. And, you know, speaking of Ascent and speaking of a little bit about like other types of practices that we use in Ascent-based practices, we talk about naturalistic teaching, client-led, client-focused sessions. Tell me a success story when you implemented this. You know, I know that there's probably a million out there, but tell me one that you can think of that really stands out to you by implementing more of those Ascent-based practices.
Yeah, I have a learner now, and she uses an AAC device. Most sweetest girl you'll ever meet. I can say that about all of my clients, honestly. But I took her case over from another BCBA, and her programming consisted of, you know, the good old first then board and will tolerate transitions. And, you know, I'm meeting with caregivers and trying to identify what their goals are and kind of, you know, what their hopes, you know, for her are. And none of their goals were aligning with what was in the programming. I was hearing, we want her to increase her communication, because that's honestly the biggest deficit we're seeing. You know, she does really well in school and she has supports in school. And we were hoping that in ABA, right, that could be more time that we could work on communication and also, you know, how to communicate in those times that are really hard, right? The transitions away from preferred activities are really hard. So, you know, it's time for her to go home and she still wants to play with the toys and, you know, at the center and that's hard, you know, which I love that it's hard for her to go home. You know, I love that she's having so much fun, you know, but I watched a session. So I kind of waited and I didn't come in there. Like there's a lot of goals. I was like, okay, I want to change this, but also I try to be very careful. And if there's something that maybe I still don't like, and it's not how I would do it, but it's working for the learner, everybody's happy and good. And the parents are good with, you know, with it. Who am I to change it? Cause that's a lot of drastic change and honestly more response effort for me. Yeah, but, you know, I watched the first session and the whole session involved, not the whole session, I should say, but during work tasks, right? It involved her flopping to the floor, crying, screaming, kicking. You know, she would hit her head with a closed fist and hit her thigh. And, you know, she was just so upset. She was throwing her AAC device because she was saying stop and those words were not being listened to. And I was like, I'd throw mine too, you know, talk her across the room. I'm saying stop and you're not listening to me. So now I have to scream and kick you. So after watching that, I couldn't watch that for the full session. So I was like, so that's where I say it wasn't the full session because I was like, I told the RBT, I was like, hey, we need to pause and let's build some rapport and let's dial back. Let's work on manding. We need to rebuild our rapport because you do not have it right now. And from there, I listened, you know, to what parents wanted for her. And I took out the first then board and we took out the DTT. And I was like, we are just going to use naturalistic teaching to increase communication. And we are going to use those, you know, replacement behaviors by increasing communication to hopefully decrease, you know, our behaviors of concern, right? So she went from upwards of 50 instances of these behaviors to now none. That's amazing. And she's reliably saying, I need a minute, stop, and I want more time, I want to go here, and it's amazing.
Love. I love that so much. And you know, it's reasons like that we do what we do. It's not to have power. It's not to control like what we want our learners to learn per se. It's getting them to feel empowered enough because at the end of the day, these clients are going to grow up to be adults that need to have these highly necessary skills. Advocacy is so important. And again, you know, the fact that you were able to identify the major issues that were going on in that session from the very moment and you knew to flip the switch and say, okay, it is time to do something different with this particular program. And you got buy-in from parents, clearly. You got buy-in from the client. Probably got buy-in from the technician, I imagine, too.
Yeah, they were like, thanks.
And so going from, you know, the SIB tantrums 50 times to zero, that's so significant. And they're reliably advocating for themselves. Again, listen to your clients, people.
Yes. And I do see some analysts who I'm like, yeah, I love that you're teaching that replacement behavior of asking for a break. And then I see it in practice and it's actually not being used because, right, they're like, well, we need to follow through. Whoa. Why do you have the replacement behavior in there if you're not going to listen to it, if you're not going to use it?
Right.
No wonder they're upset.
Yeah, exactly. The replacement behavior of requesting for more time, requesting to go somewhere else, requesting not to do something in that moment, that needs to be more reinforced heavily than you following through with the demand in place. And I'm saying that in quotations because honestly, like, I hate that term. I hate that phrase.
Me too. And you can argue that following through with the demand in place is not a true replacement behavior for the target behaviors that you're trying to reduce, right? Replacement behaviors go along with the function. And so if the function is escape or the function is attention, teach them how to ask for it, how to request it, how to indicate that. Following through with a demand or ignoring them does not replace the behavior. In fact, usually it increases it.
And it makes it 1,000 times worse. So yes. Again, oh my goodness. Well, let's talk about assent, you know, in multiple settings, right? So yeah. You mentioned having, when we spoke previously, you mentioned having experience both at home and in center-based settings. So how do you adapt your approach to maintain assent with your clients across different environments?
Definitely. So for the learners that I work with in home, that's their safe space. And I really try to remember that. And so I'm still making sure that I'm working on the skills, you know, that the learner, if they're able, have identified they want to work on, and same with the parents. But I'm also recognizing that I'm in their home, and just like I would if I was going over to somebody's house for the first time, I have no power here. And in the center, you know, I recognize that this is a more like sterile environment, a more control, or can be, right, if you use it that way. But I recognize that they're not in a safe space. And so I work to create those safe spaces and the trust and the self-advocacy, you know, so really just recognizing where I am, what I can do, and how much power I have over my learner. I would argue in the home, I don't have as much power because that's a safe space. You know, there's a lot more variables. And in the center, I have a lot more power and I recognize that and I make sure I dial it back.
Yeah. And I'm glad you mentioned, you know, the fact that this is the home is their safe space and you don't have power in the home. And something that I try to remind people is when you are in the client's home, that's their home. You are not the dictator of their home. You know, they can kick you out at any point. If you do one thing to mess up that rapport, you're done.
Yes.
You know, same thing with classrooms. This is not your stomping grounds. This is their environment. We're there to support. We are not there to tell them what to do. And being in situations where I've had BCBAs who have tried to basically like force the teacher, force the parent, hey, you have to do it like this, that just sets you up for failure because you are now trying to be this dominant being in an environment where you should not be a dominant being in.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So I'm really glad that you talked about that because not enough people understand that. And that's just based on my experience. Not enough people not only not understand it, but they don't apply it either.
Yeah, you know, I don't know if you've heard the white coat effect. That really has stuck with me in my, you know, psychology undergrad days is the white coat effect and the, you know, everything that goes wrong along with that and authority. I am in a position of authority and in a position of power because of my education. And everybody that I work with is entrusting me to, you know, provide a therapeutic service and do it well and make sure that I'm listening to them and being compassionate. And I'm going to show them that I am a compassionate individual. It goes back to the four letters, right? Sure. All this stuff. Yeah. I can give you, you know, the tools. I can, you know, hash out ideas with you. But at the end of the day, you're the parent, you're the client. I'm just here to guide and support. I'm not here to direct. And I think that's the difference between, you know, a leader and a dictator, right?
Very that, you know, and it's interesting because I actually made a suggestion just a couple of weeks ago about a kid, one of my kids is toilet training program, and the dad and I was talking and he goes, well, you're the expert on, you know, you're the expert at the end of the day. I'm like, I'm the expert, quotations, expert on behavior. You are an expert on your child. You're the expert on your child. So if you feel something is wrong, come advocate for me because I want to make sure that I'm listening. And
yes.
I think saying things like that and actually not saying it, but being about it actually gets you more buy-in because you're actually providing an individualized service. Something that is, once again, folks, in our code of ethics, you know? Yes. So, and of course, too, looking back, you know, being a BCBA, of course, reflection is absolute key in growth. You know, we've both been in those shitty situations where we've had to follow through with the demand in place and follow that shitty BIP where we had to do the 3 prompting procedure and all of that garbage, you know. So my question to you is, how do you evaluate the effectiveness of your ascent-based interventions, and what feedback do you find most useful to you?
Yeah, I think one of the most useful things, I'll answer that part first, for me, is I've had the opportunity to work with, you know, other analysts or even RBTs who are neurodivergent, even one RBT who is on the spectrum and has received ABA in their younger years. And I have found them so unbelievably useful because they can tell me about their experiences and they can, you know, they're my check-in buddies. Hey, I'm thinking of doing this, or I did this the other day. You know, was that okay? Was that too much? Was I, you know, what do you think? I check in with parents. I check in with the learner if I'm able. You know, I check to see if my clients are having fun during their session. Am I seeing a lot more, you know, behaviors of concern happening, or am I seeing a lot more smiling and laughing and giggling and whatever their version of fun looks like? And also, you know, if we're going to talk about it, you know, clinically, do I see progress? Do I see my learner learning? Do I see them growing? No, I'm probably not doing something right. So between observing the facts and the data in front of me and collaborating with other people, my check-in buddies, you know, I think I'm kind of set, and that's what's helped me the most. And just asking questions.
Yeah. I mean, I think that goes such a long way. I'm right there with you, you know, asking questions, seeking feedback. You know, it's not enough to assume that you're doing it right. It's more that you need to seek it out and actually gauge a better understanding of, is this really what I should be doing? And also, am I doing the right thing for my client?
Yes. No, you're exactly right.
I love it. So I'm going to go ahead and talk about the second code word of the day. The second code word is SNIFF. That is S. N-I-F-F. That word is sniff, like sniffing cheese, like a rat sniffs cheese. So a couple more questions I have. So what advice would you give to new BCBAs or even like student analysts looking to incorporate more ascent-based practices into their work?
A lot of what I do now for student analysts is, you know, for me, what was most impactful was social media, right? That's how I was able to label things I was already feeling. Social media can be very powerful, and that's how I've been able to connect and be a part of the critical ABA friends, you know, critical friends of ABA movement, and just learn and see what's out there. And it's, you know, kind of be in the know, like up to date. Having conversations, right? If my clients are able to communicate with me on what's working, what's not working, what they like, what they don't like. And for new BCBAs, be okay with making mistakes. You know, I think when I started learning about compassionate care and ascent, I was definitely fearful. I was like, oh, I have a lot more power now. What if I mess it up? What if I do it wrong? What if I make a mistake? And it's okay, because I've created enough trust and rapport with my learners that there is that forgiveness, right? We forgive our friends and family members for making us upset or annoying us or making a mistake, right? Because we trust them and we know that they're going to have a behavior change. And that's also part of it, is if I do make a mistake, I recognize it and I change.
Agreed. You know, imposter syndrome is so very real. And it's one of those things where we have to reflect on our own behavior. You know, as I said earlier, like we reflect, we make the changes, and then we move forward and change our own behavior.
Exactly.
Yeah. And finally, looking ahead, what aspirations do you have for your professional practice and for the future of ascent-based approaches in ABA?
I hope to become an expert in ascent. And ultimately, I just want to disseminate ascent and ascent-based practices to everybody, everywhere. Even if they're not in ABA, I want to tell them about it. I'll tell the person at Dutch Bros or Starbucks, hey, do you know what about ascent? Maybe I'll make like a shirt or something. Ask me about ascent.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I love it. Please make that. I would buy like at least 5 of them.
Got it.
Oh, well, thank you so much, Bryce. I really appreciate your time and you coming onto the podcast tonight. Where can our listeners find you?
Yeah, I'm on Instagram at the ABA Unicorn. That's the best way to find me and where I'm active most often. I do have a little Etsy shop linked there. So if you're an earring person, I like to make art, guitar pick earrings. So you're more than welcome to check that out, but not obligated by any means. And maybe you'll see the Ask Me About Ascent shirt on there one day.
Oh, yes. I really want that shirt to be published. I need that shirt. Oh, my goodness. Well, thank you so much again, Bryce. I really appreciate your time. And thank you, listeners, for tuning in tonight. I've been your host, Michelle Zeman. I hope everyone has a good rest of their night. Take care. And I'll see you on the next one. Bye.